And speaking of Spark, how creativity works, our longtime executive producer, Julie Burstein, who put the book together, is in the studio with me right now to talk a little more about it. Welcome back, Julie.
Thank you, Kurt. This week I have something a little more difficult for us to look at, but I think very rewarding, and that is to talk about artists who stand in what the educator Parker Palmer calls the tragic gap. He doesn't mean tragic sad. He means tragic inevitable. And what he talks about is people who can hold the tension between the world as it is and what we hope it might be. And so these are artists who can look squarely at heartbreak and at war and at death.
I think the point that you just made about looking squarely at things is so important and so applicable to everybody's life in dealing with difficulty, in dealing with life.
Yes, and that's sometimes the hardest thing to do. And that's why I thought these three artists were really people we should hear from again.
Who's the first?
We have Lynn Nottage first. She is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. She wrote Ruined in 2009.
Great play.
Really wonderful play about a really tough subject, which is women in the Democratic Republic of Congo who had been brutalized in their civil war. And she didn't want to just look at the awful side of this.
I wanted to look at the human side. I was really interested in what happens to the human spirit and how does love continue to flourish in the face of such ugliness and brutality.
That was a terrific play, Ruined. And one of the things about it, it avoided what this kind of art often risks doing, which is turning into a polemic and with everything black and white. This is a very emotionally complicated play. She doesn't sort of sugarcoat anything, but there's also humor, there's compassion, there's all the range of human emotion.
There's life in this play, and she was very careful, she said, to make sure that it wasn't a polemic. Though she did do her research. She went to Uganda and she interviewed women who had fled the Congo. And she said she found to her surprise that they were eager to talk to her because they said no one had ever asked them to tell their stories from beginning to end, because some of these stories are very, very disturbing. From these interviews, Nottage created her characters, such as this one that we're going to hear now, Salima, who describes working in her garden one morning, her baby playing right near her.
The sun was about to crest, but I had to put in another hour before it got too hot. It was such a clear and open sky. Oh, this splendid bird, a peacock, had come into the garden to taunt me and was showing off its feathers. I stooped down and called to the bird, "Hst, hst," and I felt a shadow cut across my back. And when I stood, four men were there over me, smiling wicked schoolboy smiles. "Yes," I said. And the tall soldier slammed the butt of his gun into my cheek. Just like that. It was so quick, I didn't even know I'd fallen to the ground. Where did they come from? How could I not have heard them?
One of the things that I encountered when I was interviewing women is a lot of them spoke of not anticipating the moment, is that suddenly the men were upon them, and they were either in a field or they were in their homes, and someone kicked in the door, and then they were there, so that their daily life was suddenly interrupted. And one of the things also in that moment I was conjuring, I was just thinking of 9/11 on that day, which was just such a clear, beautiful, absolutely perfect, pristine day, and how suddenly our lives can be changed so absolutely in a moment.
That's something, when I heard her talk about that, I could relate to so powerfully, that idea of something changing in a moment, in part because of our experience right here at Studio 360 during the attack on the World Trade Center, which was just down the street from our offices. And on 9/11, we looked to art, too. Remember that show we did a few weeks afterwards where we just needed to look to art for solace?
Exactly.
And then a few months after that, you spoke to the amazing photographer Joel Meyerowitz, who had documented what had happened there.
And what's so interesting about Joel, whose work I've loved forever and who I've known a little bit as well, is so much of his previous work were photographs of these beautiful Cape Cod sunsets and things like
yes.
that. And he told me the story of how he decided right after 9/11 – partly because he lived near the Ground Zero site, that he had to make an archive of this destruction and went down to the site while it was still smoking and smoldering and being cleared just a couple of days after the attack.
And like all the other passerby, I stood outside the chain link fence on Chambers in Greenwich, and all I could see was the smoke and a little bit of rubble. And I raised my camera to take a peek just to see if there was something to see. And some cop, a lady cop, hit me on my shoulder and said, "Hey, no pictures." And it was such a blow that it woke me up in the way that it was meant to be, I guess. And when I asked her why no pictures, she said, it's a crime scene. No photographs allowed. And I asked her what would happen if I was a member of the press. And she told me, "Oh, look back there." And back a block was the press corps tied up in a little penned-in area. And I said, "Well, when do they go in?" And she said, "Probably never." And as I walked away from that, I had this crystallization, probably from the blow, because it was an insult in a way. I thought, "Oh, if there's no pictures, then there'll be no record. And so we need a record." And I thought, "I'm going to make that record. I'll find a way to get in because I don't want to see this history disappear."
And his pictures are extraordinary and moving and powerful, but they're also beautiful because he can't help but make beautiful images in a certain way. So I asked him if that felt uncomfortable to make such gorgeous pictures of such horror and devastation.
Well, you know, ugly, I mean, powerful and tragic and horrific and everything, but it was also, as in nature, an enormous event that was transformed after the fact into this residue. And like many other ruins, you go to the ruins of the Colosseum or the ruins of a cathedral someplace, and they take on a new meaning when you watch the weather. I mean, there were afternoons I was down there, and the light goes pink, and there's a mist in the air, and you're standing in the rubble. And I found myself recognizing both the inherent beauty of nature and the fact that nature as time is erasing this wound. Time is unstoppable, and it transforms the event. It gets further and further away from the day, and light and seasons temper it in some way. And it's not that I'm a romantic. It's that the reality, I mean, I'm really a realist. The reality is there's the Woolworth Building, you know, in a veil of smoke from the site, but it's now like a scrim across a theater, and it's turning pink, you know, and down below there are hoses spraying, and the lights have come on for the evening, and the water is turning acid green because the sodium lamps are on. And I'm thinking, my God, who could dream this up? But the fact is, I'm there. It looks like that. You have to take a picture.
Also, I think, again, it's a key to creativity. His idea, I'm going to go down there every day for a year, and he did. I mean, people think of artists having great inspirations and then creating their masterpieces. He realized, because he's been in this doing this work for 50 years, that it's a matter of going and doing the work every day, even in this horrific environment.
And I'm so grateful that he did, because now, almost 10 years later, you go to that site and it's entirely changed. And so what we have left is his pictures of it.
Exactly.
To end, I wanted to bring in an artist who doesn't look at a world trauma. What he does is he looks at a personal trauma. This is the poet Donald Hall, who was here a year after 9/11 for our show on memorials. And he talks about how, after the death of his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon, work on the poems that became his book Without was really what sustained him.
In Without, at one point, I'm talking to my dog before I sit down in the morning to work on my poems, and I say to him in a kind of manic glee, "Poetry Man is suiting up." And that's how I felt. And for that first year after Jenny died, I could work on the poems of Without for a couple of hours, perhaps. And then I had 22 miserable hours to wait until I could get back to them again, because I can't work on poetry all day. But the 2 hours were the only hours of happiness at that time.
And when you hear Hall, you hear the life in him and the humor. And one of the things about the poems in this book, some of them are just heartbreaking, but others are really funny. And he talked about how people got a little upset about that, that he said he would put jokes in that his wife would have loved, that she would have roared with laughter about. And that was really important to him. He travels around the country reading his poems, and he often reads these poems, some of the most devastating poems. And Donald Hall said, inevitably, someone will come up to him after the reading and say, "How can you read that?" And he said, "It's not a problem."
They start out as screams of pain, and as I work on them, they will come to be something outside me. It is as if I were working with hacking away at a piece of stone to make sculpture or modeling or trying to paint, adding a little dash of this and that, so that they become works of art. They become a work of art in the art that I love, that I've tried to practice since I was 12 years old. Then they are objectified. They're out there. They start from the pain. They start from the anguish, these poems do. And then they become something that means to be in itself as language, as sound, as imagery, objects of pleasure, objects that give pleasure.
I've never heard a more succinct and perfect summary of what art at its best can do. He went on to talk about this is one of the paradoxes of poetry, of all poetry for thousands of years, as well as art, that the subject, because we all deal with it, is death so often and defeat and loss. But there's not one way to react to those things.
Absolutely. And all of these artists are doing that. They're reflecting on these terrible things that happen to us and taking us someplace else.
So I'll let you come back next week if we talk about something happier.
Absolutely. And I think these are not unhappy things. These are really powerful, and I think in my own life, of the way that work and art have helped me through some of the most difficult things I've ever had to encounter.
Julie Burstein, thanks.
My pleasure.
Julie is the author of Studio 360's new book, Spark: How Creativity Works, which comes out next week. You can find out more about it and how to get a copy of Spark at our website, studio360.org, our wonderful new website that is so truly new and improved, I almost can't believe it. Go there now.